This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tim Wright is a former Fulbright scholar who suffered a traumatic brain injury and for an extended period of time lost his cognitive abilities. Here's what happened. Wright had been doing research in Bolivia, studying what it means to be gay there. From 1993 to 95, he worked in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, as the regional gay men's outreach coordinator for HIV/AIDS prevention. One night in 1995, during Mardi Gras, or Carnival as it's known in Bolivia, Wright was brutally attacked and beaten. He was left in a coma and nearly died. Wright has no memory of the incident, but he knows that he had been partying and drinking and suspects that he may have picked up a man who brutalized him. He doubts he'll ever know for sure. It took years of therapy for him to overcome his brain injury. Wright's mother has written a memoir about his slow recovery called Someone Stole Yesterday. Joining us is Tim Wright and his brother Richard Wright, a professor of criminology at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. He worked with Tim during his recovery. I asked him to describe the cognitive and physical abilities he lost after he was beaten.
The most, perhaps maybe two things or three things that were the most critical. For one thing, is life without a short-term memory is very, very difficult. I could get lost in my parents' house. I wasn't raised in that house. They retired and moved to a house I didn't grow up in. But nevertheless, how hard is it to find your way around a house? I could go to one room and then not remember where I'd just been. I could try to brush my teeth, but after I got the toothbrush out, I couldn't remember what the next step was. Or if I had already, if I did finally remember, I couldn't remember, did I put the toothpaste on already or not? I had no memory. So that was really hard. Another thing was that I could only pay attention to one thing at a time. And I could often pay very intense attention to one thing at a time. But for example, one day I was trying to listen to a conversation, and I was trying very hard to listen to my mom talk to me. And we're sitting in a position where I could look out the window, and she couldn't. Well, outside, my dad was barbecuing hamburgers, and he caught on fire.
Wow.
His whole upper arm was burning, and I sat there and didn't see it. I saw it with my eyes, but I continued the conversation because all I could do was listen. That's all I could do. When he finally put the fire out on himself, he had to run, get a hose, put the fire out, he came running in, you know, frantic. He said, what's going on here? I'm burning. You don't even come and help me. And then I got out of the mode of listening to the conversation that my mother had been telling me, the words my mother had been speaking. And I said, oh my God, you were on fire. Suddenly I realized I had seen the whole thing. I had known the whole thing. But I couldn't react. I wasn't doing that then. It was pretty bad. And the third thing, I think, was just the emotional swings. It was a very spontaneous life, a very uncontrolled life. If I was angry, you would know it. If I was happy, my laughter might be actually very inappropriate and very long and very loud and really not very nice to look at. But I had no control over the flow of emotions, the flow in and out of emotions. Like those three things were pretty hard.
Tim, you had been a Fulbright scholar. And so, I mean, you had the goods. You were a smart guy. And you had lost a lot of your intellectual ability during this period after the beating. Did you miss it? And did you realize what you had lost?
I have to say, I vacillated between two extremes. On the one hand, to a large extent, I really enjoyed my brain injury in the early phase. I wasn't able to contemplate the long-term changes that might take place in my life. That was not what it was about. It was a time when I really paid a lot of attention to these one things I mentioned before, but I don't think that anyone can really know how powerful I could see a yellow or a green or a red. eating was just so great because the taste of a food would just overwhelm my entire body. There was nothing else in the entire universe. I think a lot of people would love to have that experience. But then there would be times when I would realize what I had lost. Most concretely, I lost my home in Bolivia. I lived there 3.5 years. It's a long time. And the friendships I had there meant a lot and mean a lot to me. And where were my friends? I really regained full consciousness. Tim, you've experienced this accident, and you were medevaced. You're not in Bolivia, now you're in the United States. It took a long time to get there, but when I got there, I felt really, really a terrible sense of loss. It took me a long time to get realistic. You asked me about your Fulbright, you must have really been bright. Did you, sense the loss of maybe having lost your intelligence? It took me a long time to even think about that. And I was quite unrealistic also. I announced I was going to do really quite grandiose things quite early on. My long-term memory was perfect. I can engage in a bright, interesting conversation early on, even while I couldn't do very basic skills to get through life. And I couldn't sort out. I couldn't sort that out.
Richard, when your brother was going through this period when he had no short-term memory and when a lot of things weren't quite adding up, did it give you any comfort to know that he was spending a lot of time living in the moment and really enjoying the color yellow and really enjoying eating to its fullest? I mean, did that make it any easier to watch him go through this, or did it just look really sad to you?
Well, sometimes when I was with him, it was clear that he was really enjoying himself, and the intensity of his experiences were really awesome in the truest sense of that term. But I was also just kind of devastated by how alone he seemed inside his own head. I just felt like he's experiencing things that I can't touch or feel or know anything about. And it was very obvious that that was the case. You could see him thinking. You could see him in this ice. He was actually enjoying himself, but I saw it as a prisoner, as something in which he was trapped. And I think it's really only as he recovered and started telling me how really in many ways enjoyable this experience was, or at least enlightening this experience was, that I began to feel better. But I have to say I spent many years, probably 2 years, almost never looking to my right or never looking to my left in regard to my brother's recovery. I had very tall walls on both sides of me. And I looked forward because it would be just terrible to either think about what had happened or to sort of think about what could be if this hadn't occurred. And so I really just spent all my time looking forward and just refused to think back.
Richard, what did you do to help Tim in the process of recovery?
Well, Tim and I worked together on an article that really tried to make sense of the work that he was doing in Bolivia at the time that he was injured. It was quite lucky, really. I mean, some of these things seem almost miraculous. I had gone to a conference very shortly after Tim was injured in Great Britain, and one of my former mentors, my PhD supervisor, cornered me and said, "You have a brother who works in Bolivia, and I'm doing a book on sort of the sociolegal control of homosexuality around the world. And would your brother be willing to write an article?" And it was an amazing request because, first of all, this guy's a psychiatrist, and I just told him that my brother had suffered this brain injury. This was only a few months afterwards. And although it seemed like it would be difficult, on the one hand, I decided, well, I'll raise it with Tim and we'll see what we can do. And so we began, and Tim readily agreed to do it. Now, this was a long-term project, and it involved a lot of organizing. And so we worked on this project for several months, communicating every day back and forth, via mostly via the phone, sometimes over email. And he would come out and visit me on occasions. And we worked for many months to put together an article that began to make sense of some of the work that he'd been doing.
And Tim, you were able to keep up with this intellectually because you still had your long-term memory.
Yeah, I think that in terms of the story I had to tell based on the years of experience I had had in Bolivia, I knew the story very well. I knew the story very well. And the outline that Richard and I made together was much tighter than I would normally need to have an outline be. It was, do this, then do this, mm-hmm. and don't deviate. Don't think about something else. Just stick with this. Well, on the one hand, the brain injury was quite useful because I was able to disappear into one topic and really only think about this one topic, and suddenly this skill, this quality of having a brain injury turned into an advantage. And I was able to concentrate well. I have to say it was an act of just, it was a tremendous risk on my brother Richard's part, because how did he really know? How could he be sure if what I was saying was based on any sort of reason? He took a lot of risk at that time. And I look at it now, years later, I've had it read by a few, most of my friends don't speak English, but I found a few Bolivian friends who do read English. I've had them read it. And the one criticism I've gotten is that it's really mostly about Santa Cruz, not about all of Bolivia, and yet it claims to be about all of Bolivia. That's the one criticism I think that really stands as valid. But basically, yeah, it's right. We did it.
My guests are Timothy Wright and his brother Richard Wright. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Timothy Wright and his brother Richard Wright. We're talking about Tim's slow recovery from the traumatic brain injury that he sustained after being attacked and beaten in 1995. Tim, tell me more about the therapy that you had to help you get back everything that you had before physically and cognitively, and if you feel that working on this paper with your brother kind of fit in as part of the therapy.
Well, it fit in beautifully. The most important part of the therapy was just the support I got from my family, which became quite concrete in helping me eat, helping me get dressed, helping me get to places. For example, this article that Richard and I wrote together, my parents woke me up every day with breakfast in bed and drove me, because I couldn't drive back then, to the library, because that's where I wrote this, by hand with a pen. And I slept at that time around 16 hours a day. So my days were very short. And they would drop me off and they would pick me up. And you know, more than anything, they believed. I think beyond the family, I would give the most credit to my speech therapist. She's a person who came over to my house. It was about twice a week. And not only did she help me speak, my speech was very blurred for a long time, but she also helped me cope with such things as ordering in a restaurant. I would get a menu, and it was this ocean of words, just so many. And I would start reading on the upper left-hand corner and just going down with no sense at all of captions or, well, why am I reading the soup category if I know I want a salad, not a soup? I didn't have that figured out yet. And she would just bring a menu and put it down and help me think about how to think about looking at a menu. She helped me get skills like, if you know what place you're going to go to eat, get the menu before you go, so you won't be stressed out thinking about not being able to get through the ordering off of a menu experience. She did so many things like that. At the same time, I had a neuropsychologist who my dad refers to as a princess of darkness, because she was the one who put the brake on. She was the one who said, I announced long ago, I'm going to go get a PhD. Well, that was very far from reality. And she would say to me, after, you know, working on it for a long time, if you think you want to go that direction, it is possible. It's possible that it's possible. But you have to take steps along the way to see if you can get there. And it was a great thing, because it made me see quite clearly that yes, I was it was realistic, but it was going to take its own time.
How much of your recovery is a function of time healing, and how much of it is a function of the things that you did with the help of your therapist and the help of your family to push things along and regain your skills?
Yeah, I don't know for sure. They say that how well your brain recovers depends on how good it was to begin with, and also how your overall health is,
mm-hmm.
and third, how much support you've got. Well, you can see that I used my brain a lot before. I'm in good health overall, and I had a healing situation, a support network of people who were just working on this all the time. In a situation that most people just don't get.
Mm-hmm.
I kept getting asked a lot if I was going to commit suicide. I never thought about it once. But psychologists have to ask that, I guess, nowadays, and doctors, and who knows who all. And I had never even thought of it. But it made me think to myself, well, am I supposed to think about this? Is it really supposed to be that bad? Well, I'm enjoying so many things in my life. I'm enjoying life every bit as much as now as I had before. Why would I think about that? But people kept wondering if I wouldn't commit suicide, maybe I'd give up. Well, the thing is, what do you do when you give up? What does it mean to give up? What do you do the day after you give up? You get up, it's time for breakfast, and you've given up. So what do you do all day long? I couldn't figure it out. Does it mean I can't read a book? I'm learning how to read again. I'm enjoying it. I'm having a good time. Is that all okay? I want to go to the gym. I can't do that. I should do that. Many things, I just no idea what they're talking about. To me, I just got going again. It was very frustrating as I got, we're talking months down the road now, I did begin to notice more clearly the problems I had. And that was probably harder in the beginning, the early stages. And then I really was really depressed. There was kind of a, I'll just stay in bed, I'm depressed all day long. But I just am too curious about life. There's too many things you want to go out and check out.
Now, because so much about you had changed, cognitively and physically, I'm wondering if any of your tastes changed too. Did you enjoy different books, different music, different movies than you did before? I mean, even were wondering about like your sexual feelings, if your sexual orientation was as gay as it was before, if your sexual drive was as intact as it was before.
Right.
If that's too personal, please don't answer it.
No, I mean, on that issue, I woke up gay. It was a curious thing for me because sex is not as important as other things like breathing air and eating food and taking care of your basic bodily functions. And when you're reduced to the level where you can't do anything but just take care of the basics, sex really was so unimportant. I didn't think about it for a long time at all. And during that time, I contemplated what it means to be gay when you have basically no sex drive. I realize I am gay, and I'm not sure what gay means anymore. Because what does it mean when you're gay? When you're confident, I'm sure that I'm gay. I know that I'm gay. That is a part of my identity that is just alive and well and intact. But I'm not very interested in sex. I'm not really attracted to men sexually right now. So I went through that. You ask about taste in general, about preferences overall. And yeah, there were a lot of changes. I used to be a natural leader type personality. That was largely based on the assumption that I knew everything. My assumption, I knew everything. I don't know how I pulled that off, but I always was sure I knew everything. And now I'm quite sure that I don't know much. And I'm a follower more than I notice that. I notice that all the time in my life, that when somebody else takes a leadership position and they're going to organize the group, I'm happy they're doing it. And I'm willing to say, yes, I will do this. Yes, I will do that. to cooperate and get along and be useful to the crowd, but I'm no longer am I the person who wants to organize everything. In discussions about issues, I find all sorts of points of view interesting and possible. I'll sit there and think to myself, well, that could be.
Tim and Richard Wright will be back in the second half of the show. Their mother has written a memoir about Tim's slow recovery from traumatic brain injury. It's called Someone Stole Yesterday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tim and Richard Wright. We're talking about Tim's slow recovery from a traumatic brain injury. In 1995, when he was in Bolivia doing AIDS outreach work, he was beaten, left in a coma, and nearly died. With the help of extensive therapy, he slowly recovered his cognitive and physical abilities. When he was at the point where he could think about his work again, his brother Richard, a criminology professor, helped Tim write a paper about the work Tim had been doing in Bolivia on homosexuality and AIDS. Richard and Tim's mother, Helene Wright, has written a memoir about Tim's recovery called Someone Stole Yesterday. I asked him if his brain injury affected his religious feelings.
Obviously, that was going to be the next direction this had to go. And I find it curious that it's easier to say I'm gay than it is to say I'm religious. I don't know what that means about the place we're at in the world or what it means. But it was the profound spiritual experience of my life. I was not raised particularly religiously, but I woke up quite confident that life is just great, and beyond it is love and warmth and something good, and that's where we're going. I woke up in a very good mood about the spiritual state of humanity in light of all the crises I see. I was not in a state where I could choose what religion to be. That was all too confusing, too complicated, and I was not raised, we were not raised particularly religiously. I think our parents were very interested in morality, but I might have been dragged into a church a few times as a child. I barely remember it. I was never baptized. And suddenly, because I couldn't contemplate what religion to be, and I hadn't been raised religiously, I had to make a choice. And I went to an Episcopalian church, and I've never left. It's kind of a gay thing to do. It's got a reputation of being kind of a gay sort of a church. And yet it takes care of my spiritual needs quite nicely, and I'm really, really happy I'm there.
Richard, you're a professor of criminology, and your brother was the victim of an attack. As a criminologist, how does your work as a criminologist affect the way you see the attack on your brother, and how does this attack affect what you're interested in as a criminologist?
Well, not only am I a criminologist, but at the time that Tim was injured, I was actually studying active armed robbers on the streets here in St. Louis, Missouri. And Tim's injury really caused me to think a lot about what I was doing. And I have to say that I left the field and stopped that project. I continued to write about it, but stopped actually doing fieldwork for that project on the day that I received that phone call. I still do studies of active offenders, but it has caused me to think a lot more about what I do. But of course, criminologists do more than just study active offenders. I mean, we also study the justice system. And probably the thing that I've been most affected by through Tim's injury is I've realized that it's just no good seeking vengeance. I just don't see that as a worthwhile part of the justice system. I think that we have other things that we need to be doing, and it just isn't any good to seek, to use the justice system to get even with people.
Well, in this case, you don't even know who the criminal was.
We don't, but I have to say honestly that I never wasted a minute trying to think about who did it or what should happen to them. That has never caused me a moment's worry. I think in part of it, you just don't have the energy to do it. You've got other things to be thinking about.
It might have been, too, that the perp was in a different country. I mean, you were physically so far away from that.
It's true. I was removed from it. And I think also the fact that Tim had survived may make a difference. Had right. he died, you could have been maybe consumed with the idea of vengeance. I have to say, honestly, in this situation, I wanted to devote every bit of energy I had to my brother's recovery. And I just didn't have any emotional energy to devote to seeking vengeance. But I have to say, honestly, that I always wondered how crime victims felt about things. And I was not a direct victim, but this was pretty darn close for me. And anger is not one of the things that I ever felt.
Tim, what kind of work are you doing now? Are you following up on any of the research that you were doing in Bolivia before you were attacked, research on gay men in Bolivia and on HIV in Bolivia?
I am working now on a PhD in anthropology at UCLA, focusing on gay identity in Bolivia, very specifically.
And that's interesting that you're still connecting to that interest and the work that you did before the attack. So there isn't this big divide of what I was interested in before and what I'm interested in now.
I have to say something. I loved Bolivia. I was very happy living there. And Bolivia was very good to me. Yes, I had a bad day, a real bad day in Bolivia. But the country was good to me. And the way same-sex lives are organized. People like to have sex with their own sex. The way that is organized in Bolivia is so different than anywhere else I've been, certainly the United States, that it drives me. It's so interesting. I have to know more about it all the time.
Give me a small example of what you mean.
Well, in Bolivia, for example, it's very likely that when two men have sex together, one is seen as a homosexual while the other is understood to not be a homosexual. That's just one example.
Right, because one is the, quote, male role, so therefore he's not
homosexual.
Right,
that model exists, I know, in lots of parts of the world, and especially in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
I think it exists to varying degrees in different places, and it changes as countries grow larger cities and have more complex economies. But in a country like Bolivia, where people really rely on their families for their social support all the way through their life, there can be no separation from the family. And this is a model that's set up that makes it possible for people to stay within the overall working of the system of Bolivia, the systems of Bolivia, and carry on with their lives, get some sexual satisfaction, and work within the system. And, you know, as I say, it can be argued for and can be argued against. Nevertheless, it is what is to a large extent and is changing only very slowly. And as it changes, new opportunities open up and new problems arise.
Tim, your mother wrote a book about your injury, your brain injury, after you were beaten, and the impact that that had on the family. And the book is called Someone Stole Yesterday. What's it been like for you to read your story from her point of view? Because she might have seen certain things differently than you saw it and might have interpreted your actions differently than you intended.
Well, I have to say, when I read it, I've read it several times now, and when I read it, I realized that we really are alone to a large extent in life. By that I mean, I had my brain injury experience all by myself. The times that I was just in a state of exhilaration and tremendous joy, they were agonizing over the fact that I couldn't function. Yet meanwhile, they were also very alone. Both of my parents I'm thinking of right now, were also very alone because, how good can it look when you see your son drooling while staring at a flower for 30 minutes, unable to handle any bills, any telephone calls, any interactions with the Social Security Department, with all the insurance companies, etc. I couldn't do any of that. In fact, I didn't even know it was happening. So they were off on their world together with each other. I'm glad she wrote this book. I think it's a wonderful book, especially for people taking care of somebody with a brain injury. And it really taught me a lot of what they, and now I know what they were going through. And I'm really proud of my mom for having done it. But it, as I say, someday maybe, I'm not really planning it concretely, but maybe someday I might write a book of my own experience of it. And it would look, it would be a complimentary book, but it would be quite different.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Richard, Tim, thank you.
Thank you,
great.
Tim and Richard Wright are brothers. Their mother, Helene Wright's memoir about Tim's slow recovery is called Someone Stole Yesterday. Coming up, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn of The New York Times talk about their reporting from Asia. This is Fresh Air.